Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Thousands of former coal miners are fighting for their lives. They suffer from a deadly form of black lung disease.
The only thing I could liken it to is like if somebody ever holds you underwater till you thought you were going to drown.
You know, it's just like turns your lungs to concrete.
An NPR investigation found more Appalachian miners are contracting the worst form of black lung.
The day you pick that dinner bucket up and go in the mines, that's the day you sign your death warrant.
Investigators over the past 6 years into the deadly black lung disease have found that miners are finding it tough to get help from doctors, lawyers, coal companies, and many lawmakers. We'll hear what former miners and their widows have to say to lawmakers about skirting the black lung issue. Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Here in Appalachia, we're all too familiar with black lung disease and how it takes the breath away from our coal miners. In the 60s, miners organized a movement to end black lung. They convinced Congress to pass new laws that were supposed to make the chronic disease a thing of the past. But conditions underground have changed, and black lung has come roaring back. Back in 2013, an investigation by the Center for Public Integrity into the misconceptions of black lung and the maze of benefits revealed a system in which coal miners were fighting an unfair battle for disability payments and medical care. CPI found that the industry's go-to law firms had been withholding evidence that proved miners had black lung. The investigation also found that some doctors rarely and sometimes never diagnosed patients with the disease. Then in 2016, NPR's Howard Berkus uncovered that black lung disease was far more widespread than ever before. He found that a new generation of Appalachian coal miners had advanced forms of black lung, but federal regulators didn't tell the same story. In the second half of our episode, we'll hear more about that investigation. But first, let's hear from the miners themselves. We start in Leatherwood, Kentucky, where Howard met miner Greg Kelly.
Greg.
Hey,
I'm Howard Berkus from National Public Radio. Great to meet you. Do you want to go in and talk?
I'm Greg Kelly. I'm in Leatherwood, Kentucky. Well, I dropped out of high school. I was working in a grocery store, and I left the grocery store and went to coal mining. I felt like coal mining was my way of living.
It was something that was in our blood that we love to do. My name's Charles Shortridge, and I live in Meadowview, Virginia, and I've worked 28 years in the coal industry. We love working in the coal mines. That's all we knew was hard work, and that's how we provided for our families.
I love coal mining. If I was able today, I'd be working in the mines. My name is Paul Kinder, and I live in a little town called Honeacre, Virginia. My full career was underground, and I run a roof bolter some and a contiguous miner, and I was a foreman, and, you know, I just loved it. I remember when I was a little boy, my daddy sometimes would take me to the mines where he worked at, and, man, I loved the smell of that. It's just a different smell. I'd like to go smell one today. It was a good job, and couldn't wait to get to work.
My name is John Gibson. I'm from Appalachia, Virginia, and I'm 56.
Harold Dotson. Live in Phelps, Kentucky.
My name is Jackie Yates.
My name is Noah K. Counts. I live in Clintwood, Virginia.
My name is Rodney Sexton. Coal mines was good to me, but God's been even better. That's the only way I can look at it, you know. The one thing I didn't want was black lung, but I got it anyway.
What's it like now with the disease for you?
Oh, it's terrible. Bill Cantrell, I'm from Benson Port, Kentucky. I mean, it's unexplainable. It's just, I don't know how to explain it.
It's a horrible looking thing. You got nodules that's on your lungs. It's caused from coal dust, rock dust.
You know, it's just like turns your lungs to concrete.
You just stop breathing and you just wake up and there you are, you're awake.
I'm Jack Horn and I'm from Kemper, Kentucky. The only thing I could liken it to is like if somebody ever holds you underwater till you thought you were going to drown, and when you come up, you're gasping for air, and that's about what it's like, you know, when you have a lung attack.
And I hate it so bad I can understand it at times, but it's affected my whole being.
Tell me your name and where you're from.
Edward Fuller from Steele, Kentucky.
Looking back on your mining career, can you think about what it was that happened that might have caused your black lung?
Yeah, the coal dust. The dust.
I was in the dust all the time. James L. Muncy, M-U-N-C-Y. I come out of there, he's white as a sheet of ghost. Well, I come out of there, and the only thing you see me was mice.
You just watch it fall off like ash. It's thick.
My name's Roy Mullins, Roy Edward Mullins from Clintwood, Virginia. You can smell it. You can taste it.
And when you come outside, you get a drink of water or Coke or whatever, you know, and you hark it up and spit it up, you're spitting up gooks of coal dust. And that is embedded into your system.
That's just the way it is, really, I think. My name's James Hayes, and I'm from Pike County at Pinson Fort, Kentucky. You know, I mean, it's a dusty job. It's just dusty in the coal mines, regardless. And if you stay long enough, you're more likely going to get black lung.
I blame the whole mining industry, you know, the companies and all. I'm Jimmy Wampler. I work for little mines. I work big mines.
You got people out there that runs mines that all they want is coal. They don't care about violations. They don't care about nothing else. They just want coal.
Coal. Get the coal. Get the coal.
They don't care if you live or die. It's the truth of it.
Name of the game is run coal.
My name's Danny Thornsbury, and I was a boulder man, scoop man, drill man, done it all. And then I ended up being a foreman. There was just a lot of laws that was couldn't really do in mine coal profitably.
Roy Sparks, I'm from Rock House, Kentucky. The companies has got so, they're so slick, I mean, you know.
Fudging everything.
It's a hide and seek for real. They try to act like they're complying with the laws. Even the inspectors know they're not.
And you had to do what they said. If you didn't, it's your hide.
You kept your mouth shut. If you didn't, they'd argue. So I just kept my mouth shut and went on. But I paid for it in the long run. Sure have, and I'm sure every other miner has too.
Just almost every guy that I know in our church was a coal miner. My pastor, he had black lung. Bill has black lung. Mike has black lung.
My father-in-law.
I got an older brother's got black lung.
My brothers, my uncles.
My dad's got black lung.
Just the whole generation, you know, everybody around me, the whole neighborhood.
And I think Papa does, and me.
Since 2011, I have lost 7 friends.
And knowing that that's coming to you, it's pretty hard to take.
I tried to talk my son out of it. I tried to get him to go to school. You know, when he got out of high school, I said, now look, you're going to go to school or you're going to get you a job. And he said, nah, I want to stay here. And he said, I'm going to go into work in the mines. And so he did.
I said, you'd be 30 years old with black lung, you don't want this. No, Dad, I want to work in the mines. I want to be like you. And guess where he's at? He's working in the mines.
The day you pick that dinner bucket up and go in the mines, that's the day you sign your death warrant. That's plain and simple.
I go out and I just sit down and have a good cry. You know, that's all you do. Because it's black lung. It's a death sentence. But, you know, we just got to take it one day at a time and hope for the best. Hope, pray that the good Lord just bless us to have another day.
Those were the voices of 17 former coal miners in Appalachia. All of them have advanced black lung. That piece was produced by NPR's Kat Schuchnecht from interviews collected by Howard Berkus and the Ohio Valley Resources' Benny Becker. That story originally aired on All Things Considered in January. In my job, I've met a lot of people whose stories stay on my mind after I've interviewed them. Sometimes I even stay in touch with them. One of those persons is Robert Bailey. When he found out that he had a story to tell and it could help someone else, it was important for him to share it. Over the last 4 years, Bailey and I spoke several times. He frequently reached out to me to let me know what was happening with black lung policies and regulations and with his health. Robert Bailey was a coal miner for 36 years. He began in McDowell County, and after it became too hard to breathe, he retired from a mine owned by Patriot Coal in Boone County. Bailey first told me his story in June 2014.
It's a struggle just to receive the help that you still need.
The occasional puff you hear is oxygen that's being carried through tubes into his nose to keep him alive.
I'm in the process of a lung transplant, but black lung insurance is protesting any further treatment toward this case.
At this time, Bailey was waiting to hear if Patriot Coal's insurance company, Underwriters Safety and Claims, would approve his appointment for a medical evaluation. He'd already had to cancel one appointment. Bailey had already been approved for federal black lung benefits, and his doctor told him he needed a double lung transplant.
It's almost like drowning. You might breathe as hard as you can breathe, but you can't feel the air. You're not getting any quality, no use out of it. Even though you are breathing, it just don't help you. And you feel your whole system shutting down, and like you're about to melt to the floor.
As Bailey waded through another bureaucratic process, the clock was ticking, and Bailey was running out of time.
And they told me that as soon as my testing was done, that they would put me on a list. So that tells me that they don't think that my lungs have very much life left in them. But now I'm in a waiting game of waiting on the insurance to verify their approval for me to receive this treatment.
4 months later, Robert Bailey's lung transplant was approved by Patriot Coal's insurance company. But when the bankruptcy was finalized, the company had shed these responsibilities. So Robert says the money came from a federal fund that covers black lung benefits for bankrupt coal companies. Not long after his surgery, I visited Robert in his house in Princeton.
Last time I saw you, I'm pretty sure you had tubes coming out of your nose. I could hear that it was difficult for you to breathe. Explain to us now, if you could put it into words, what it's like to be able to breathe again.
You really don't know what it feels like until you're struggling. But it's about like somebody capping their hands over your mouth, and you're trying to breathe and you're struggling and you're really working real hard, and you can feel it affecting your whole body, not just your lungs. But now, since I've had my transplant, and it's no struggle at all, and it just makes you relax and smell the roses.
Bailey explained to me that without the double lung transplant, he'd probably only have a few years left. Years with less mobility and a constant struggle to breathe. The situation made him very aware of his mortality and the limited time he'd have with his family.
And plus having their birthdays and realizing that how fast time does go by, that each one of them is getting older and their looks are changing and they're just growing up. And next thing you know, they're going to be grown like I am. And if I hadn't had this time added to my life, I would miss all of that.
A double lung transplant comes with its own set of health challenges. About half of all adults who receive a double lung transplant live 5 years after the surgery, and the medicine Robert had to take after his transplant weakened his immune system. Robert became a miner's advocate and spoke twice to Congress during Senate hearings, urging lawmakers to act quickly in order to reduce the backlog of black lung cases that needed to be evaluated.
I'm hoping that through my experience, other people could maybe have better results with the issues that comes up against them.
About 2 months ago, Robert learned he had an aggressive form of liver cancer. Doctors gave him weeks to live, and he was put on hospice care when he got home. His daughter reached out to me on Facebook to share the news. Mr. Bailey wanted to share more of his story. I went back to talk with him at his home the next day.
I wasn't really shocked about it, totally. I mean, it wasn't news that I was looking forward to hear, but I knew it was news that we would have to deal with. God give me my first breath, he'll take my last one.
The nurse came in a few minutes after I arrived. She walked into the kitchen to talk with Robert's wife of nearly 46 years, Brenda. Their house was busy with phone calls and visitors. Through the commotion, Robert reflected on his struggle with black lung. He told me that while doctors said his liver cancer was linked to his transplant medications, he pointed out that it wouldn't even be an issue if he hadn't contracted black lung to begin with. Mr. Bailey was a humble man, but he still wanted to share his story with hopes that his suffering and his death wouldn't be in vain.
Even though I've been granted and been blessed with this extra time that I wouldn't have had, it would be so much better in the long run if the disease itself would be conquered.
He often wondered if he could do something different as well.
I just spent too many hours. A 10-hour day was about a normal day, seemed like, through my career. I just worked too many, too long hours.
Robert said he hoped his story might help inspire lawmakers to take more steps to improve health conditions for other miners, and perhaps even prevent other coal miners from the same suffering. He pointed out that traditionally, laws don't change until miners die, and sometimes not even then.
No, I don't want the things I went through just to drop and no knowledge to be gained, no people to be helped.
Robert Bailey passed away 28 days after this conversation. At the memorial service, his family told me that Robert talked about me often. I guess I just didn't realize how much. They said they know Robert is in a better place, with no more suffering, and his wife has found peace in knowing this.
My father was a carpenter. My mother, she died young. I'm the eldest of my brothers. You're the trouble in my blood.
Today's show is in honor of Mr. Bailey and the thousands of miners who suffer from black lung disease. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Stewart's Opera House, presenting the Nelsonville Music Festival in Nelsonville, Ohio, June 6th through the 9th, featuring Death Cab for Cutie, Mavis Staples, Tyler Childers, The Breeders, The Wood Brothers, Mandolin Orange, and many more acts on 5 stages over 4 days. Tickets and information at nelsonvillefest.org.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
The clock is ticking for miners with black lung just as time is running out on a federal program that helps miners who struggle with the deadly disease. Before the break, we heard the story about one man's fight to receive a lung transplant, and even though it only gave him a few added years to his life, he was grateful that he ended up receiving that medical care. Other miners struggle with a similarly confusing and tangled path for benefits. After Patriot Coal's bankruptcy, the Federal Black Lung Program inherited the costs of care for former miners like Robert Bailey. He received his double lung transplant with money from the Black Lung Disability Trust Fund. It's a federal program that provides benefits to tens of thousands of sick coal miners. But that fund is running out of money, and last winter, Congress went home without resolving what the future's going to be like for sick miners in need of medical care. Becca Schimmel has been reporting on this for the Ohio Valley Resource, and she joins me now. Hi, Becca.
Hi, Jessica.
Becca, this money essentially pays for health care and disability for coal miners who suffer from black lung if their former employer can't pay or can't be found. There's been several reports of coal companies declaring bankruptcy during the latest industry decline, so it seems that this would empty these funds pretty quickly.
Yeah, it's definitely challenging the fund. You know, the closure of more coal mines means fewer employers are contributing to the fund by paying that tax on the coal that they extract. So already less is going into the fund because there are less open coal mines, and add to that that tax rate has gone down on those open mines, it'll put more strain on that fund. And this comes at a time when we're seeing an increase in cases of black lung in younger workers.
But coal companies have been paying taxes into this fund for years. Why is it running out of money?
Right. So the fund's been around since about 1969. It was part of the Federal Coal Mine Health and Safety Act that passed right after the Farmington mine disaster. But it was running out of money, and so in 1981, Congress basically doubled the tax and then renewed it 10 years ago. But from the industry perspective, they're saying that they need this coal tax rate to go down because they're already facing significant economic stress. You mentioned the latest industry decline. They're kind of using that and saying that we need this relief in order to keep paying into this fund. Otherwise, we're going to be so stressed we might have to close more mines.
So has there been any movement in Congress on this?
Well, Senator Manchin from West Virginia did propose a bill back in January to increase the tax that would help pay for the fund. But when we spoke with him around that same time, he said without Senator McConnell, it wasn't likely to get a floor vote.
Well, Mitch McConnell is the one person that's holding us up on this. I hate to say it, but one person.
Essentially, what Manchin is saying is that McConnell, as the majority leader of the Senate, it's kind of on his plate to bring it forward, a way to renew the fund. Someone else who'd like to see this bill pass is Carl Shoup, a retired miner in Kentucky.
Senator McConnell is one, he's the most powerful senator in the world, you know, as far as that goes. If he gets on this, he can push it through. And I believe that. And I hate to put that on him, but it's the truth, you know.
So what does McConnell say about the Black Lung Fund?
Well, last year he told the Ohio Valley Resource they wouldn't let it come down to the wire.
That'll be taken care of before that would get into an expiration situation. It just won't be allowed to be unfunded.
And yet, Congress closed out 2018, letting the current tax rate expire.
Yeah, this set it back to the tax rate from the pre-1981 level. And budget officials are estimating that by the middle of next year, there won't be enough money to fully cover the fund's benefit payments. But that doesn't mean it'll run out of money by next year. It just means that the benefits people are receiving now could be reduced, and it might be harder for them to get benefits in the future.
You know, Becca, growing up in the coal fields here in southern West Virginia and starting to report on the mining industry some myself, it almost seems like it's part of the culture, which has now created an even greater burden for the coal miners.
Dealing with black lung and this surprise, you know, advanced cases of black lung has really hurt the families of Appalachia as well. You know, they're seeing their family members suffer from this. And on top of, you know, seeing them suffer from black lung and advanced cases of black lung, now they're having a harder time getting the benefits that they need. And it could get even worse.
With a system that just doesn't seem fair. Becca Schimmel reports on jobs and economics for the Ohio Valley Resource. Becca, thanks for staying on top of this issue and giving us the latest on this important topic.
Thank you, Jessica.
So as we just heard, the Black Lung Disability Trust Fund could be $15 billion in debt by 2050 if nothing changes with the tax rate for coal companies. That could mean reduced benefits for miners suffering from black lung, and it might make it harder for others to qualify for benefits. It's not just the miners who suffer because of the disease. Their widows are often left to pick up the fight for benefits. Sydney Bowles gathered stories from women whose husbands worked in coal and who died from what the widows believe was black lung. But obtaining benefits from the federal government's black lung program became a fight that lasted years.
Vicki Salyers remembers scrubbing black soot from her husband's work clothes.
When he came home, I mean, the only thing you could see would be like the whites of his eyes or his teeth.
Nancy Potter says her husband didn't want to admit he was sick.
I said, can you breathe good? Is walking hard? Or he said, I'll be all right. I'll be all right.
Like generations of women before them, Salyers and Potter sent their husbands off to work in the region's coal mines. And like generations of women before them, they watched their husbands' health deteriorate.
He would cough up this black goo.
He got tired real easy.
And then he'd just stay sick all the time, and they'd tell us that it was bronchitis. You know, they treated him for bronchitis for like 3 years.
It even got to the point, you know, we had to raise the head of her bed and put bricks under it so it would get him, raise his head up.
I miss him more than anybody will ever realize. I would not ever wish him back to suffer like he did.
Salyer's husband Eugene died in 2013. Potter lost her husband in 1997. Both women sought federal black lung benefits through the Department of Labor. Their experiences show how a system designed to help provide for coal mining families became a complicated and fraught bureaucracy.
The black lung benefits process is highly adversarial.
That's Evan Smith, an attorney who represents miners and widows in black lung benefits cases.
For people who just file a claim and kind of think they can figure out the system on their own, you know, sadly, they're really at a disadvantage.
For many women, the fight lasts for years. Nancy Potter's fight has lasted 22 years.
It is very, very tiresome.
Nancy and Rich Potter had the kind of marriage that made other couples jealous. He took her on spontaneous trips. She wore her Daisy Dukes just for him. Rich died of a heart attack after decades of coal employment. Potter filed a widow's claim right after Rich passed away.
They kept just turning me down, you know, turning me down. So, and every year I try to do something to keep it going because I'm sorry. But I've just tried every year to do it, and I always thought, you know, I'm going to get it any time. I know he had black lung, and they know he had black lung. But he died with a heart attack, and they said it had nothing to do with black lung. And I said, how can that be? Because if you have it, it puts an undue burden on you, on his heart.
A benefits review board found in 2009 that Potter had been denied due process rights, and her claim from 1997 was still viable. She pursued that claim and was denied. Potter has sent her story to the Department of Labor's Inspector General for review. The case is still pending.
I had faith they'd do the right thing, you know. They'd do the right thing. He had black lung, but they're not doing the right thing. I don't know that I'll get it, that someone will see it and say, what is wrong with the system? It's due him, and I'm going to stay with it and fight it to the day I die.
Vicki Salyer's trailer is up a steep driveway in rural Rush, Kentucky. While we spoke, she sat in the chair where her husband used to sit before he got sick. Salyer's and her husband, Gene, never had much money, but in 2002, they bought their trailer brand new.
First new thing we'd ever had. Our first year in this in this trailer, he bought me a new crock pot and a new sweeper. And I guess I'll remember that forever. I guess because we got a new house, he thought I needed a new sweeper to go with it. But he was so proud of this trailer.
In addition to having several other lung diseases, Gene was diagnosed with lung cancer in 2009 on Christmas Eve.
And the doctor come in and he said, there's no easy way to tell you this, but you got lung cancer. And we fear you might live 6 weeks. But he fought for 5 years. He had several major operations. He had one of his lungs removed. They had to open him up, and this whole side was left open. And I had to dress it every day. It was open for about 4 years. He couldn't hardly eat anything. He couldn't breathe. He would just gasp. He says, are you ready? And I said, where are we going, honey? He said, well, we're going to heaven. And I told him, I said, I can't. One of us has to stay here with Zach and take care of him and Riley. I said, we both can't leave him. And he died at 10:10 that night. You have that one person in your life that you love with your whole heart. And he was mine.
In her grief, Salyer struggled to keep up with her husband's black lung benefits claim.
They'd ask you all these questions, and you're like, you know, hello, I'm country. I don't know this stuff, okay?
But Salyer's filled out the forms. She went to court, and at the district director level, she won. Gene's employer appealed the case to an administrative law judge.
The company, the coal company, had, like, so many days to appeal it. Here's what they do. They wait till that last day. You know, you get excited a little bit. And then they wait to that last day and they appeal it. And then starts the process over again. And that went on for like 2 years, I bet you, or longer.
Salyer's case went all the way to the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals. Of the roughly 7,000 black lung cases filed each year, only 50 or so reached this level. Finally, in October 2018, she won. She was awarded $48,000. But the money hasn't come.
I know it don't mean nothing to them, but I'm about to lose the only thing that me and my husband had together. because I have to struggle every day to decide, am I going to pay the electric bill this month and the water bill, or do I pay the trailer payment this month? You know, it's not an option. They don't know what it's like to struggle like that. They don't have a clue. If they had to sit here and see him die, they would not put people through that. They wouldn't. They would just give them the benefits and just say, you know, it was deserved.
Salyers is behind on her trailer payments. Unless the money comes soon, she'll lose her home. For the Ohio Valley Resource, I'm Sydney Bowles in Whitesburg, Kentucky. Despite mounting evidence and a stream of dire warnings, federal regulators and mining companies failed to protect miners from toxic dust. NPR and the PBS series Frontline spent more than a year looking into this. NPR obtained documents and data that show federal mine safety officials had evidence of the danger more than 20 years ago, but they never addressed it. And now at least 2,000 miners are dying from an epidemic linked to the toxic dust. NPR's Howard Berkus traveled across Appalachia to meet many of those miners and bring us this story.
Before we get to why it happened, here's why it matters. Listen to some of the 36 coal miners we interviewed, all suffering from progressive massive fibrosis, the advanced stage of what's known as black lung. It's a disease that turns lungs crusty and useless.
The doctor says my lungs started shutting down. I said it's hardened just like a lump of coal.
It's bad when you can walk outside and all that air out there and you can't get none in your lungs.
For instance, trying to take a bag of trash out, steps and hills, I can't even walk up my driveway and check my mailbox.
And whenever your grandchildren come up, they say, let's go out and play ball or let's go look at the creek or something or other, you ain't able to walk out with it. It makes you feel about an inch high.
You get up hacking, spitting black and blood.
Coughing to the point of almost throwing up.
It's a death sentence.
We're going to die from it.
There's no cure for it.
It's going to kill you.
And knowing that that's coming to you, it's pretty hard to take.
That's from inhaling coal mine dust for Roy Mullins, Jimmy Wampler, Edward Fuller, Charles Shortridge, Jackie Yates, Bernard Carlson, Roy Sparks, Greg Kelly, Lacey Dutton Jr., and Jerry Helton. They mined coal underground and above for 20 to 40 years in Kentucky, Virginia, and Pennsylvania, and they share simple milestones for ruined lives.
It's like cutting grass, and I got a big yard, and there's only one part that we have to have actually push mowed, and it's 18 passes is what it is.
Danny Smith pushes a lawnmower in front of his white ranch home in a holler, a narrow valley in Canada, Kentucky. He wears a t-shirt, jeans, and ball cap, and a cloth dust mask stretching from eyes to neck.
And I used to be able to mow it in about 6 minutes. And the last time that I tried it, it took me about 6 hours to cut it. And I'm not exaggerating at all. And I would have to stop and go in and sit down and rest, put my oxygen on, then go back out and make two or three more passes.
Smith spent only 12 years mining coal. 6 years ago, he says, when he was only 39, he was diagnosed with progressive massive fibrosis. And after a few minutes mowing, Smith spits up a wet crust, dark gray with black streaks. It's dead lung tissue. It dies so fast it just peels away, his respiratory therapist says. Smith recovers enough to settle into a chair on the porch and clips to his nose a tube that leads to an oxygen tank.
I'm terrified. I'm scared of suffering like my dad suffered because I sure don't want to go through what he went through. I've seen a lot of guys that died of black lung and they all suffered like that. I worry about my kids and my wife and how are they going to make it when I'm gone. And it's heartbreaking. If I was to die tomorrow, they'll lose everything.
In the last 8 years, more than 2,000 coal miners were diagnosed with progressive massive fibrosis, according to black lung legal and medical clinics surveyed by NPR in Ohio, Pennsylvania, West Virginia, Virginia, and Kentucky. Some are part of the largest clusters of the disease ever reported, says Scott Laney, an epidemiologist at the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health.
I think this is clearly one of the worst industrial medicine disasters that's ever been described.
Laney and his colleagues have also documented the highest rate of basic black lung since the early 1990s among miners still working in central Appalachia with at least 25 years on the job. One in five has the disease, he says.
We're counting thousands of cases, thousands and thousands and thousands of black lung cases, thousands of cases of the most severe form of black lung. And we're not done counting yet.
Here's what NPR and Frontline discovered about why this is happening. In the last 30 years, miners in Appalachia cut more and more rock while mining coal, rock that contains quartz. And when quartz is cut by mining machines, it creates fine and barbed particles of toxic silica dust. Almost all the sick and dying miners we interviewed, with 12 to 40 years in mining, describe more of this rock in coal seams. That includes Bill Cantrell, James Muncy, Harold Dotson, and Randall Owens.
Back in the 80s and early 90s, I was a lot of just mostly coal. But as it went on, no matter where you went, you had rock.
Probably the last 20 years, I've cut more rock than I cut coal.
All the good seams were gone because there weren't hardly no solid seams of coal left. And there were more rock in the coal.
A little seam of coal probably 8 inches thick. The rest of that was rock, 6.5 foot.
The more rock you had to cut, the dustier it was.
It's like being in a room full of smoke.
Like you're sitting in a cloud.
Like walking into a fog bank.
You're inhaling that into your lungs as well.
You know, that's just like fiberglass that cuts your lungs out of hell.
It'd choke you up.
I used to spit it up constantly.
We just couldn't keep the dust down good enough.
Everywhere I worked, we cut rock.
The silica dust that results is easily inhaled and lodges in lungs forever. Epidemiologist Scott Laney.
It makes a huge impact because silica is a lot more toxic than coal mine dust. Somewhere around 20 times more toxic, and it can cause disease much more rapidly.
So get this. NPR and Frontline documented thousands of instances in which miners were exposed not just to coal dust, but to that toxic silica dust at dangerous levels. That's what we found in 30 years of data collected by federal regulators. They measure coal and silica dust where miners are working. And 85% of the time, they reported safe levels of silica. But the rest of the time, there were 21,000 instances of dangerous exposures to silica.
That's what causes disease, is the excessive exposure. I think if the intent of enforcement is to reduce exposure and you're getting overexposure, it didn't work.
Jim Weeks is an industrial hygienist who has worked for the Federal Mine Safety Agency and the United Mine Workers Union. NPR and Frontline found that federal enforcement does not directly address silica dust. If there's too much silica, mines are put on a much tougher limit for overall coal mine dust. That's supposed to lower the silica exposure because the coal and silica dusts are usually mixed. But it didn't always work. There were still dangerous levels of silica or quartz close to 9,000 times in the last 30 years.
They didn't pay sufficient attention. And, you know, we got the bodies to prove it. I mean, these guys wouldn't be dying if people had been paying attention to quartz. It's that simple.
And when federal mine inspectors issued citations for too much silica, which they did only a fraction of the time, they said more than 9,000 miners were affected. Now, the data only show what happens when regulators are checking. They often didn't check during some of the most dangerous exposures.
This was a big operation right here.
Not far from his house in Kentucky.
I won't pull on their property, but that's it right there.
Danny Smith slows his SUV as we pass an abandoned coal mine. He and other miners use drills and mining machines here, cutting through solid rock underground to get from one coal seam to another.
You know, there's a rock dust. We had all kinds of air, but I was still breathing it all in, I guess, anyway, regardless.
And how many days, weeks, months?
Oh, it took months to do that. Oh, Lord, it was 7 days a week, minimum 16 hours a day.
This is called slope mining, and it's not really mining. There's no coal involved. It's all about cutting through solid rock to get to coal seams. And because there's no coal, there's no requirement for sampling the air for dust, even if it's the most dangerous dust. That's optional. Danny Smith cut at least two slope mines.
Is it possible that your disease came from cutting through solid rock for hour after hour, day after day, month after month?
Very possible, yeah. Most of my mining career, I run a continuous miner. I run a roof boulder also, and it's very possible from all the hours that we worked.
Roof bolters drill into solid rock. Continuous miners cut rock and coal. Dust is supposed to be controlled by massive ventilation fans, curtains that channel air, and constant water sprays. Sometimes they worked, miners told us, and sometimes they didn't. There's also this. Dust masks or respirators are not required. Miners who use them told us they often didn't work anyway.
They would clog up with dust, wet, and spit. I just never could get enough air. And then it feel like somebody just sitting there with their hand over your face. About to give you a heart attack trying to breathe through it.
They're not going to stop 100%.
There's finer particles getting through them filters that creates what I've got.
Some of the companies I work for didn't have them at all, period. I mean, there's no such thing as a dust mask.
Noah Counts, James Hayes, and Edward Wayne Brown are among the miners who weren't protected by dust masks. In fact, dozens of other miners, including Danny Smith, are suing dust mask suppliers. There's also this. Federal law makes masks secondary and optional in protecting miners. First and foremost, the law says, is keeping mine air safe. It all adds up to this for Celeste Monforton, a top mine safety official in the Clinton administration.
It's a combination of the regulations were not adequate. The enforcement of those regulations was not sufficient. And the mine operators themselves were not held accountable.
That didn't seem to be the direction back in 1992, when presidential candidate Bill Clinton met with coal miners in West Virginia, suffering from black lung.
He's going to be our nominee. He's going to be our president. He's from Arkansas. His name is Bill Clinton.
Clinton told the miners and a crowd in Charleston that he knew what black lung could do, because he represented miners seeking black lung benefits when he was a young lawyer in Arkansas.
I saw those big strapping men who could no longer push a lawnmower across their front lawn, who could no longer pick their grandchildren up. Some of them could not even make their own beds in the morning. And I learned a lot about what a caring government would do as compared with what a heartless one would.
We found internal memos from the Clinton administration that showed alarm way back then about a cluster of advanced lung disease among coal miners as young as 40. The Mine Safety and Health Administration warned the industry back then about excessive exposure to silica and severe disease among miners. A Department of Labor Advisory Committee and the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health called for separate regulation of silica and an exposure limit twice as tough. Davit McAteer led the Mine Safety Agency at the time.
And we started a national campaign.
first to raise awareness. And it was that campaign that began to try to go after the silica requirements and raise the silica standard and start on a separate path to control silica.
There were other dust control loopholes so big you could drive coal trucks right through them. Loophole number one, mine inspectors did not check for coal and silica exposure most of the time. They inspected just four times a year underground and twice a year at surface mines. Loophole number two, sampling devices did not check for mine dust the entire shifts miners worked, despite more and more overtime, double shifts, and six-day weeks. Loophole number three, when inspections turned up excess silica, mining companies could then take their own samples of mine dust unsupervised. They could average the results, which hid the worst exposures, and their samples were sometimes fraudulent, resulting in criminal prosecutions as recently as this year. Loophole number four. It could take weeks to get dust samples analyzed for silica. Overexposure could continue for dozens of shifts. Davitt McAteer says he tried to fix it all. But the National Mining Association, the industry's biggest lobbying group, sued and won.
That threw the silica standard back, and we weren't able to pick that up again and go forward with that. And then we ran out of time. And it's something that's unfortunate and put a lot of labs at risk in the meantime.
Remember, this was 20 years ago. There were clusters of severe disease like there are today. Miners were sick and younger like they are today. And cutting rock, creating silica dust, was blamed then, too. There's nothing new about any of this, except thousands more miners are suffering severe disease. And silica is still not directly regulated. Celeste Monfort.
We failed. Had we taken action at that time, I really believe that we would not be seeing the disease that we're seeing now and having miners die at such young ages from exposures that happened 20 years ago. I mean, I don't know how you can reach any other conclusion. I mean, this is such a gross and frank example of regulatory failure.
Nothing changed in the next administration of George W. Bush when a former coal mining executive ran the Mine Safety Agency. Then President Obama put Joe Maine in charge. Maine came from the United Mine Workers Union, and he was on that Labor Department Advisory Committee that sought tougher regulation of silica back in 1996.
So it was very obvious that that whole scheme that had been in place that has left so many people sick had to be changed and had to be fixed.
Maine closed some of the big loopholes. No more sampling by mining companies, no averaging of samples, no sampling for just part of the work shift. New, real-time coal dust sampling devices were deployed to make the process more honest. And the exposure limit for coal mine dust got tougher, but not for silica.
A high tide rises all boats, as the saying goes. We were going to get a benefit out of reducing the overall dust exposure by what we did. Would not only lower coal mine dust, but all dust that was part of that, including silica.
But as we found in the agency's own data, that formula had failed thousands of times. Celeste Monforton wonders why the agency missed that or ignored it.
The fact that you went back for 30 years and looked at that data, and that data was available to the agency to assess as well, why wasn't that problem recognized and rectified?
None of the former agency officials we spoke with could explain that. They thought they were doing what they needed to do. But another agency did act on silica, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration. So now every industry that cuts rock, every industry except mining, has those separate and tougher regulations on silica. Joe Maine left it to the Trump administration to address silica in mining.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome our lecturer today, Secretary Zatezal.
At West Virginia University in September, President Trump's choice to lead the Mine Safety and Health Administration spoke to mining students.
Well, thank you so much.
David Zatezlo is a former mining industry executive and lobbyist, and his agency declined multiple requests for interviews. So we were there, too, when Zatezlo sounded unequivocal about silica and disease.
You hear the phrase in health circles over progressive, massive, fibrosis, these sorts of things. To me, I believe those are all clearly silica problems. Silica is something that has to be controlled.
But when we approached the Tesla afterward, he was suddenly uncertain.
I don't think the science is that well defined on it yet, Howard.
You have 2,000 miners right now. I don't think
that the science of the causation is that well defined. I don't know.
You said yourself that silica was...
No, yeah. I said I suspect silica. I didn't say it was. I said I suspect. I think until such time as you figure out what it is, you don't really know.
Excuse me, students are waiting.
So Tesla was whisked away to pose for photographs with students. So far, his agency has no plan for separate and tougher regulation of silica at coal mines.
All right, sir, I want you to take in a big, deep breath.
In a black lung clinic in St. Charles, Virginia.
Blow it out.
A coal miner stands face first against a wall-mounted x-ray panel, his bare back lit bright, except for a target shaped like a cross.
And breathe. You can go ahead and move, sir.
This clinic continues to diagnose new cases of progressive massive fibrosis at the rate of a dozen a month. The epidemic continues. So does the finger pointing. Even the National Mining Association, the industry trade group, pushed for specific regulation of silica. But mining companies also knew they were cutting more quartz. Quartz slows the mining process, and it has to be removed before coal can be sold. So why didn't mining companies act on their own? Here's Bruce Watzman of the National Mining Association.
Sure, they could have done that. But again, Howard, I'm not going to speculate on why they did or didn't do what they chose. You know, our focus here is forward-looking. How do we prevent this in the future? I can't answer for those what occurred in the past.
Isn't part of figuring out what you need to do in the future recognizing maybe what you failed to do in the past?
Sure it is. But at the same time, I recognize that we're doing better today than we did in the past, far better.
The Mine Safety Agency says the same thing, based on new data on those changes Joe Maine pushed through a few years ago. Mining companies now meet exposure limits for coal dust and silica 99% of the time. That's a deceptive statistic, says epidemiologist Scott Laney.
Well, they're sampled very infrequently, so we don't know what's going on with these miners when they're not being sampled. 99% of the time, we don't have information on that.
And it'll be 10 years or more, given the time it takes for disease to develop, to know whether the new dust rules really work.
They can't stop us from parking on the road.
Danny Smith pulls up to a parking lot choked with weeds. This was a Massey Energy mine when Smith worked here. Massey is a defunct company now with deadly disasters in its history and a CEO who went to prison for conspiracy to violate mine safety laws. A ball cap shades Smith's face. Sunglasses hide the tears.
It's eat at me and eat at me for at least the last 2 years that I'm going to die over this over, you know, and it's heartbreaking, you know, not knowing where you're going to have grandkids and you're going to ever see them and of all the things that could have killed me while I did work there, rock falls and all that stuff, you know, and I lived through all that. And I find out years later that I'm going to die over black lung, and it's heartbreaking.
Despite a downturn in mining, coal mines still employ about 50,000 workers nationwide.
We was all young and strong and stout, and they took advantage of us. Every one of us is either crippled or dead, you know. We was all young men. We were just kids.
Back at Danny Smith's house, in the holler in Canada, Kentucky, a small family cemetery sits at the edge of the lawn he has so much trouble mowing. It holds a single gravestone bright with flowers, and chiseled into it are the names of his parents. Behind it, in the shade, is the plot Danny Smith has picked for his own burial. He's 46 years old. Howard Berkus, NPR News.
That story originally aired December 2018 on NPR's All Things Considered. On today's show, we heard about an unfair system in which doctors rarely diagnose minors with black lung. We heard from miners and their widows talking about how little support they've seen from coal companies. We also learned that doctors, lawyers, lawmakers, and regulators have failed to protect and help coal miners. I keep hearing the voices of the miners and their widows and thinking about their suffering. I wonder, in this system, where can they turn to look for and actually find help? Something that Mr. Bailey said before he died stands out. It was his advice to current miners.
I know a lot of does a lot of things for the money, and they're offered a lot of money to meet certain goals. But you can meet a goal today that will take you out of this world tomorrow.
And given what we know about the pressure to run coal, run coal, run coal, perhaps that might mean demanding a new way to provide for family or a new economy. If you'd like to learn more about black lung in Appalachia and some treatment options that are available for this disease, on our website you'll find even more reporting from the WVPB newsroom in collaboration with the Ohio Valley Resource and NPR. You can find the series at wvpublic.org. Until next week, thanks for joining me as we journey throughout Appalachia. Yes, we will leave. We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from NPR, PBS Frontline, and the Ohio Valley Resource, which is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and West Virginia Public Broadcasting. Music in today's show was provided by Dinosaur Burps, Adam Cox and Stan Bumgardner, Michael Howard, Alan Cathead Johnston, and Stacy Grubb, and Ben Townsend. You also heard music from Darling Side, who will be on Mountain Stage in Morgantown, West Virginia on Sunday, April 28th. More information about that is at mountainstage.org. Roxy Todd is our producer. Eric Douglas is our associate producer. Our executive producer is Jesse Wright. Brittany Patterson edited our show this week. Our audio mixer is Patrick Stevens. You can find us online on Twitter at InAppalachia. You can also send us an email to insideappalachia@wvpublic.org. On our website, you can also subscribe or download all of our stories, or look for the Inside Appalachia podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Also at wvpublic.org, you can sign up for our new Inside Appalachia newsletter. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.